25 years ago, few people outside of the West Coast could tell you the mascot of the University of Oregon. Then the football team got good and better still and got lots of national broadcast exposure and got snazzy new uniforms. Now even ESPN, the global sports network, features the Oregon Duck in its promotional messages. The elevation of the University of Oregon image was helped greatly by infusions of cash from Oregon-based Nike Corporation and its co-founder, Phil Knight. He was not the only donor. U of O is not the only school, but they are the central players in a book by Joshua Hunt called University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education. Joshua Hunt is an investigative journalist whose work has been published in The New Yorker and California Sunday Magazine, among other outlets. He's also a former foreign correspondent for Reuters in Tokyo. Joshua Hunt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You have some Eugene history of your own, I understand.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Alaska, but about the time I was starting middle school, my family moved down to the Springfield, Eugene area, and this was in the mid 1990s, and so this was just sort of before all this stuff started, just before you could see the effects of a lot of the things that I describe in my book. It was it's interesting to think about, this old sort of Donald Duck like University of Oregon mascot is what I was a little more familiar with being plastered up around Eugene, as opposed to the swooshes all over these days.
Yeah, and it really is the University of Nike with the swooshes from some appearances. And what, so aside from your own connection to Eugene and the U of O from your youth, what got you onto this story?
Well, back in the spring of 2014, I was working as a freelance reporter, and I got an assignment from the sports editor at the New York Times to go down to Eugene from Portland, where I was at the time. I was asked by the sports editor of the New York Times to head down to Eugene and look into this unfolding story that seemed to be about a cover-up involving an allegation of rape against three University of Oregon basketball players. These three basketball players playing for the Ducks were accused of gang raping a freshman, a young woman, who reported the crime immediately. This would have been in March of 2014 when the crime was reported. And then 2 months later is when this all sort of leaked to the press. Details of the accusation came out when the Eugene Police Department quietly released this long and graphic police report that the alleged victim had released that the alleged victim had filed with the police department, rather, along with her father. And it seemed really strange to us that details of this accusation emerged only after the Ducks had been bumped out of NCAA tournament play, and only after these three guys had remained on the roster and continued to play quietly with no word about this leaking at all while the tournament was still going on. We found that very fishy, and my editor and I decided that I should go and look into why the school had kept this quiet, why the school seemed not to have launched an investigation, and so on and so forth. And, what I found when I got there was a lot of roadblocks to public records, to the sorts of information that schools as particularly public schools as public institutions are supposed to hand over not only to journalists, but to members of the public. It really seemed that there was a concerted effort to treat this serious criminal accusation as a kind of public relations problem, and to just try and sweep it under the rug and make it go away as quickly as possible. But instead, what happened is I just happened to be headed off for a year to Columbia Journalism School in New York, where I was a fellow in an investigative journalism program. And so for the next year, I made this my my master's project, and essentially looked at how looked at it initially as a case of how a university mismanaged accusations of sexual assault against athletes, and then from there it just blew up into a much bigger project. You know, the questions kept getting bigger, the answers kept getting scarier, and all roads kept leading back to Nike.
I like the way you worded in the book. You began with a notebook full of questions, and over time that turned into a notebook full of answers, at which point you could actually begin to write this all up. Before we get to a break, I want to make a clear reference here. You draw a straight line from the acceptance of Nike money to the passage of the property tax rate limits with Measure 5 in 1990. You think that without that change in the funding structure in higher education in Oregon, the Nike embrace, if it happened at all, would have been very different?
Absolutely. I mean, Dave Frohnmayer, who became the who was the longtime University of Oregon president, starting back in 1994. You know, that's 4 years after the ballot measure that you're referring to, ballot measure 5. 4 years after that was passed, and about the time when the financial effects were starting to be felt really acutely in terms of those cuts to higher education funding. You know, that was the time when they were looking for outside money specifically because of those cuts.
And a lot changed over that time, where the football team got good and better and nationally known and nationally ranked, and the uniforms got snazzier, all the things that we've been talking about that are contained in Joshua Hunt's book, University of Nike, which has implications for parts of universities other than the University of Oregon as well, and not just on football playing fields and basketball courts. The book is called University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Joshua Hunt and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the draining of public money from public higher education in many places around the country, with a particular emphasis on Oregon, where the ballot Measure 5 property tax limits forced a rejiggering of a lot of public funding and resulted in the universities having a lot less money from the state and taking a lot more in tuition from the students and a lot more from corporations as well. And that is the part that Joshua Hunt focuses on in his book, University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Joshua, let's back up the Nike story just a bit, because I want to get to the creation of Nike itself. I mean, the University of Oregon and the track team were really essential to the initial success of, Nike.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, Phil Knight, of course, as many Oregonians will know, is an Oregon alum. His father went to the University of Oregon Law School, graduated from the University of Oregon Law School, as did the father of Dave Frohnmayer, the University of Oregon president, who played a really crucial role in making the University of Oregon what it is today, along with Phil Knight. And so, you know, it's in part a bit of a family legacy for Knight, who went from the University of Oregon to Stanford Business School. And then at Stanford Business School is where he had this idea for making a cheaper, a more affordable running shoe, really distributing a cheaper, more affordable running shoe, so that he could undercut Adidas, which were then very expensive imports back in the U.S. in the 1960s. And it was at Stanford that he had this idea, and it was based on what the Japanese camera companies had done to the German camera giant Leica. You know, Leica were these very expensive, very, very expensive cameras, still are today, very nice, very expensive cameras. And the Japanese companies took a huge chunk of Leica's market share really quickly by making a product that was functionally just as good and much cheaper, thanks to the low labor costs that there were in Japan at the time. And so Bill Knight left Stanford Business School with this, you know, kind of billion-dollar idea, which was to partner with a Japanese company and take advantage of the low labor costs in Japan at that time, as it was coming out of the war, be a distributor who could, in America, who could sell these shoes for much less than Americans were paying for Adidas, and yet they would be of much higher quality than people were getting in America if they were if they were buying the very cheap American Adidas competitors, which were made with like tire rubber back at that time. I mean, really low quality stuff. And so his first partner, Phil Knight's first partner in this venture, is Bill Bowerman, the legendary, you know, his track coach. He was a member of the University of Oregon track team and legendary track coach to, just about every famous Oregon runner you can think of, including Steve Prefontaine.
And you relate a lot of other side detail. The level of detail in the book is impressive, Joshua. I mean, you're talking about things like the people who passed ballot measure 5. You get into the medical issues in the Frohnmayer family. A lot of figures in here, including Michael Jordan, who certainly helped Nike become big and rich and powerful. At its peak, how rich and powerful was it in relation to other people in the athletic apparel market?
I mean, Nike really, really began to dominate athletic apparel starting in the Michael Jordan era. After Michael Jordan signs on with the company in 84, 85, you see just like this rise from sort of into the millions and millions to the hundreds of millions to the billions in terms of Nike's market cap. And this is a big change for a company that started with Phil Knight selling shoes that some other shoe company made out of the trunk of his car on the west coast of the U.S. in the 1960s, and then in the 1970s transitioning to making his own Nike branded shoes, but still being pretty much a running shoe company that's really fighting to be the top player amongst like track and field squads at high schools and colleges around the company. So then in the later 70s and then on into the 1980s, focusing on trying to capture the college basketball market, which is what they do in part with, Jordan gets a lot of credit for this. And of course, Jordan is a big part of the reason why Nike is Nike. But I think considering recent news having to do with Michael Avenatti, this lawyer who's throwing around these allegations that Nike has been, corrupting the recruiting process in college basketball by paying money to players so that they'll sign with the schools that Nike wants them to sign with. I think without taking away anything from Michael Jordan and his role as a brand ambassador in making Nike the king of the basketball shoe companies in the 1980s, it's important to recognize the role that these kinds of recruiting practices played. And in particular, a guy named Sonny Vaccaro, who starting in around 1977, goes to work for Nike, and Nike hires Sonny Vaccaro specifically because he has a track record when it comes to shady backroom deals in high school and college basketball recruiting. Sonny Vaccaro had previously founded this basketball tournament called the Dapper Dan Classic, and the whole idea was to invite the top high school recruits for this kind of exhibition game, this sort of all-star game, and then invite the top college coaches from around the country, and then give them a shot to see these kids in action, and then essentially kind of take bids and say, okay, well, this coach wants to meet with this high school student. I'll put the recruit and his family in a room with this coach. And then, you know, Vaccaro would broker these backroom deals and take his cut of the money. And, you know, because he spoke the language, he was an interloper who spoke the language of both the coaches and the sneaker company people in a way that these you know, less sophisticated players and their families did. You know, these kids are essentially just trying to get into college, and their parents are just trying to get them there. And someone like Sonny Vaccaro could sort of, you know, speak the language of these sneaker companies and these schools and take advantage of the situation, frankly, by trying to broker the best deal that they could and take their cut. And so Nike hires him specifically because they want to do this. And so that leads to the creation of what I talk about in my book as sneaker money. So what happens then is Nike comes to dominate the college basketball world by going around and making informal deals, because NCAA rules at the time didn't allow for these kinds of all school deals that we see today. And so Nike would send Sonny Vaccaro around the country to cut deals with basketball coaches, college basketball coaches, and say, you know, look, if you make sure that your players all wear Nikes, then we'll pay you the coach. Our deal is with you, the coach. We'll pay you 10 grand a year, 5 grand a year, 20 grand a year, whatever it is. And so of course a coach is going to take that deal. Mm-hmm. And then over time, when Nike's competitors get involved, like Adidas, the sneaker money contracts go from 5 or 10 grand all the way up to something like 100 grand. And so by 1986, there was so much money swirling around, so much, money that's really helping Nike to circumvent the rules that are in place and get around the rules that are supposed to prevent this kind of all-school deal from happening, and making these informal deals. By 1986, there's so much money swirling around that the schools and university presidents are complaining to the NCAA and saying, look, these coaches are getting rich, and the schools are getting no cut. And so that's when the NCAA changes the rules and allows for these all-school deals that are perfectly normal today, where the idea is, okay, Nike gets to use the players as walking billboards, and that's good for promoting the team, and the coach gets their cut, you know, not informally but formally, and then the university, the institution, also benefits by being cut in on the deal, and by getting the lion's share of the money from Nike or Adidas, whoever the deal is with. And so this guy, Sonny Vaccaro, deserves a lot of credit for this blueprint, which then, you know, like I said, makes Nike really the king of the college basketball world just at the time when it needed to be in order to woo Michael Jordan, get him on board, and then use him to do in the pros, in the NBA, what it had already done in the world of college basketball, which is just to take things up a notch and go from millions to billions.
Joshua Hunt is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an investigative reporter who has worked as a Reuters correspondent in Tokyo and had other assignments as well. He's written a book about the influence of of athletic shoe money and other corporate sponsors on higher education. It's called University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education. Major focus on the University of Oregon and Phil Knight's involvement there. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's broaden this out a bit, because it's not just the U of O, obviously. I mean, how much money is getting scattered at some of these schools, and is it and what kinds of corporate inroads are they making into things that don't involve basketball, football, that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, speaking again of this all leading back to taxpayer support, or rather lack of it, and disinvestment in higher education. The post-Cold War model for university funding in most places in America was really reliant on a certain amount of taxpayer support. And so starting around 1990, which is when Oregon taxpayers decided they didn't want to support public education at the level that they had been, and made these drastic cuts with ballot measure 5, which really, really started, siphoning money away from public support of public higher education.
And let me pause for just a moment there, Bringen. I did look up some numbers. The University of Oregon in-state tuition, you report in the book, went up 60% as Measure 5 took hold. It has tripled in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, so this process began in Oregon in 1990. It began happening all over the U.S. Just a few years later. I mean, I think Montana was just a couple years behind, and Colorado, and state after state after state after state. This is how a lot of states began dealing with everything from, broader downturns in the economy to state budget crises. This sort of, in retrospect, very bad, very short-sighted solution to dealing with these other budget problems, essentially cutting. I mean, it was obvious to many at the time that it was not a good solution to this problem, but I don't know if anyone could have guessed that it would be as absolutely disastrous as it was, because what happens is, and some people might say it sounds, particularly conservatives and Republicans often say, well, things like, well, what's wrong with letting business step in and lend a hand, or they might make the free market argument that things are going to run more efficiently and more smoothly if you put businessmen in charge of the process as opposed to public servants. And it's really not the case. I mean, yes, lots and lots and lots of money, millions and millions, hundreds of millions, and sometimes billions of dollars flow into these universities because of these deals with their corporate benefactors or their billionaire benefactors. But it's very often on the same kinds of terms that these sorts of businessmen cut deals in other aspects of their business life, meaning it's meant to benefit them chiefly, and it's meant to be whenever possible to the detriment of the person on staying at the other side of the table, in this case the university. So for example, to use Phil Knight as an example, when Phil Knight gets a $1 billion campus built at the University of Oregon, this $1 billion Knight campus for advancing scientific impact, which is on the horizon about a decade from now, a little less than a decade from now, he doesn't pay the full $1 billion. He puts up half of that. Sometimes he puts up less. In this case, he put up $500 million. That leaves the school to come up with the other $500 million. One way that they end up doing this typically is by issuing state bonds, which come with hefty interest payments. And so what you end up with are these corporations being something like a credit card, and a credit card with high interest rates, a credit card with strings attached, a credit card that is used on their terms. And so the schools can only use it for the sorts of things that the billionaire or the corporate benefactor wants to be built. And so, yes, the campus starts to look nicer and starts to look fancier, but it's a little bit hollow, and it's very much like everything else within that corporate ecosystem. So, I mean, a good example, again, to keep talking about Nike, you know, if you go by Nike's campus, everything looks very nice, very modern. If you go by a Nike store in downtown Portland or in New York or in Shanghai, you know, you see these gleaming facades and these, you know, very nice looking buildings. But what about the factories? What about if you go to the factories where Nike shoes are made and you look at really the base of the operations?
Okay, we need to find
a foundation that's fairly rotten.
All right, well, we get to the labor practices in just a moment because there was an eruption between David Frohnmayer and Phil Knight over the Workers' Rights Consortium. We'll get into that in just a few moments as we continue our conversation with Joshua Hunt on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to investigative journalist Joshua Hunt. He's been published in The New Yorker, California Sunday Magazine, and other outlets. Former foreign correspondent for Reuters in Tokyo. He's written a book that looks at the University of Oregon and other schools and corporate infusions of cash. The book is called University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education. Conversation you can join on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call. Here's Vince in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Joshua Hunt.
Hi, I'm a retired college professor from California, now living in Eugene. And I want to know if it's true. I've heard from people here in Eugene that Phil Knight was not only using his billions to build a new arena for the students, which, of course, all the students could benefit from, but he was building special tutoring center just for the athletes. Only athletes could use it, a special counseling center. And this created a lot of dissension on the campus between the students and the athletic department faculty and other faculty on campus. And is that part of the reason why maybe out of guilt he's donated $500 million for a health and science center?
All right, good question. Thanks for that, Vince. Appreciate it.
It is true that that there is an athlete only facility at the tutoring facility at the University of Oregon, funded in part by Phil Knight's money. It's called the Jaqua Center, named after a Knight associate, a former Knight associate, and a former Nike associate. And, you know, it's derisively referred to as the jock box around campus because no one is allowed into it unless they're a student athlete. It looks, from the outside, it looks sort of a little like an Apple store or something. It's glass and brushed steel and very nice looking. And, you know, inside it's very luxurious as well. And, you know, it is nice that these student athletes have, it is nice and it is important that these student athletes have access to tutoring and things like this. But this did create a huge amount of tension on campus because, you know, it's supported with tuition dollars from non-athlete students as well who cannot benefit from it, who cannot go inside. And the school has, the athletic department in particular, has tried to make it look as though it's self-supporting, but it's not. All the hundreds of thousands of dollars every year are siphoned off a general fund and used to pay for things like maintenance and staffing. And so, you know, students whose non-athlete students whose tuition continues to rise are subsidizing this facility that they cannot use, whether or not they, and they're supporting these student athletes, whether or not they care about athletics at the University of Oregon. And speaking of the Knight Campus for Advancing Scientific Impact, this, no, Phil Knight is not doing that out of guilt. This $500 million that he's put towards this $1 billion new campus that's going to be focused on science and research and so forth, that's not something being done out of guilt. Phil Knight is not a sentimental guy. He's doing that because he sees a good business opportunity. Anything that Phil Knight or that Nike does, they do it because they see it as being in their interest and they see it as being a good business maneuver. Whether it's signing Colin Kaepernick or building this Knight campus, which, by the way, this Knight campus is going to be a real big problem in the future. It's tempting to look at this and go, oh, great, this guy who's been funding all these athletics is finally funding something related to academics at the University of Oregon, and he's doing it to the tune of $500 million. Isn't that something? Well, it's a problem because it's specifically geared towards aligning university, basically public-funded research, more closely with industry interests. I mean, the materials discussing the Knight campus make this explicit. That's not a secret. And taxpayers, the very taxpayers who are going to be subsidizing that research, which might then be used by some pharmaceutical company or some other corporation that has a partnership with the Knight campus, these taxpayers who are subsidizing that research may not have any access to information to let them know whether or not they're getting screwed in the deal or whether or not they're funding research that may be unethical, because there are loopholes in our public records laws that allow for the exemption of records that otherwise would be public.
Well, this is one of those famed exemptions to Oregon public records law.
Right. Well, this is one of the few legitimate exemptions. One of the few legitimate exemptions is surrounding trade secrets, so that the University of Oregon has, I've seen it time and time again, and I've spoken to people who worked in their Office of Public Records, they abuse public rights records, and they do everything in their power to avoid public scrutiny when it comes to dealings with Nike, when it comes to athletic issues, when it comes to anything that could, cast the university in a bad light. And so it's a problem that they in the near future will be able to, you know, say, for example, cut a deal with a major pharmaceutical company to farm out research for that pharmaceutical company and have University of Oregon researchers who are either state employees or who are students benefiting from these facilities that are taxpayer supported, you know, doing research to benefit only this pharmaceutical corporation. And they may or may not be being pushed by this corporation to do things which are unethical or even illegal, and no one would ever hear about it because the emails or the correspondence between those University of Oregon researchers and that corporation could be completely exempt from scrutiny under public records laws, because the University of Oregon could just say, well, that might violate their trade secrets.
Ah, it's an intellectual property kind of thing, sure. Joshua, just a couple minutes left here now, and I want to get one major question asked before we go, because, you know, you focus on the University of Oregon and Oregon's experience with ballot measure 5, which lowered property taxes, required the state to put more money into public schools and dropped it for everything outside of the K-12 arena. What have you seen, if anything, in terms of other states, other schools and whether they found ways to non-corporate pathways to bring revenue in.
Well, I mean, this is sort of the future more than it's the present. I mean, the university, what I call in the book, the University of Nike blueprint, has been adopted more and more widely, or variations of it. In Oklahoma, you've got a school that is leaned on a billionaire benefactor, that being the oil billionaire and speculator T. Boone Pickens, a hedge fund manager. So you've got some schools that have really leaned towards a single corporate benefactor, like the Phil Knight model, and then you've got schools that have leaned more heavily on the corporate benefactor side, again using the University of Nike model. Schools like Maryland is a really good example because it's so similar. So in 2014. The school signed this $33 million equipment deal with Under Armour, an athletic apparel company that's a competitor of Nike's, and that's founded by a guy named Kevin Plank, who's an alumnus of Maryland. And after getting into the Big Ten Conference in 2014, Maryland was, they've got this big new apparel deal, all this money coming in. They're in a big new conference, and they've got, meanwhile, Under Armour has its sights set on Nike. And so the school and its athletic directors came out and specifically said, we want to do here in Maryland what Nike did back in Oregon. And they explicitly lay out, how they're going to use this University of Nike model as a pathway to overcome the funding woes that they have had over there. I mean, which were serious. They lost 20%. Maryland lost 20% of its state funding between 2000 and I think it was 2014 or 15. And, which is, again, like I said, the kind of disinvestment that's happening in states all across the country. Mm-hmm. States are chiefly dealing with this like Maryland is. They're coming up with quick, short-sighted solutions. And they're doing this because the model for a university president today is to come in, stick around for a few years, get something built, put your name on it, or have your name associated with the building of it, and then move on to the next school and a bigger paycheck. And so college presidents, university presidents aren't really dealing with the fundamental problems at their institutions. Mm-hmm. So it's just all Band-Aids. It's raising tuition and focusing on athletics and focusing on buildings so that they can end up with a nice looking campus and ignore for as long as possible all the rot that's going on underneath it. And it's a disastrous kind of solution because in Maryland, for instance, just a few years after they head down this path towards following the University of Nike blueprint, what happens? They have this young man, this 19-year-old football player, who dies last year, who dies under, very shady circumstances, basically dies of heat stroke after, this practice that everyone can see in retrospect was way too grueling.
Mm-hmm.
It takes quite a workout to kill an otherwise healthy 19-year-old elite athlete. And I think when the postmortem is done, I think whatever investigative journalist goes in and looks more deeply into that situation, I think that they'll find that a lot of red flags were overlooked, and I think they were overlooked in the sake of protecting the brand, protecting the relationship with the corporation, and protecting the athletics department, because that's what they see as the Band-Aid, as the generator of income for the foreseeable future.
Sure, bringing in the revenue as the state support drops, which is a major theme here in Joshua Hunt's book, University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education, a major focus on the University of Oregon, a thoroughly researched book. You'll meet a lot of people involved in the passage of Measure 5 and the response to it in the state of Oregon if you read the book. Joshua Hunt, thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.